Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's One Planet series. On today's Your Call, we continue our month-long series on solutions by talking about how we can convert the world's energy structure to renewables and move towards a clean energy future. Last October, a major report by the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change warned that without a massive shift away from a fossil fuel-based economy in the next decade or so, we will experience severe droughts, mass migration, famine, and flooding. And that was followed by another report by 13 federal agencies warning of major economic consequences if significant steps are not taken in the United States, the second biggest polluter in the world. And then last week, a study in the journal Science found that the oceans are heating up 40% faster on average than a UN panel estimated 5 years ago. Ocean temperatures have broken records for several straight years. In 2017, fossil fuels supplied about 80% of the energy consumed in the U.S. That is according to the Department of Energy. Renewable clean energy accounted for more than 11%. That's the highest share over the same period. So what will it take to get to 100% renewable energy? Last week, we talked about the Green New Deal and a number of plans floating around. Today, we are going to talk specifically about to get to 100% renewables. Today's guest, Stanford professor Mark Jacobson, says there is no scientific or technological barrier that can stop us from converting to 100% renewable sources of energy. Mark Jacobson is professor of civil and environmental engineering at Stanford University and director of its atmosphere and energy program. He's co-founder of the Solutions Project, which aims to make renewable energy a reality for everyone. Professor Jacobson led a study that identifies how 139 countries could obtain 100% of their energy from renewable sources by 2050. Last year, he received the Judy Friedman Lifetime Achievement Award from People's Action for Clean Energy. And Professor Jacobson joins us from his office at Stanford University. Hi, welcome back to the show, Mark. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me on the show, Rose.
Well, it's great to always have you on. Last week, we talked about the Green New Deal, which is getting a lot of attention. It starts with transitioning to 100% renewable energy by 2030. About 45 members of the House have signed on to this so far. And in recent years, we've seen an explosion of activism centered on divesting from fossil fuels. Keep it in the ground. Mark, you've been working on this with your team for about 10 years. How significant are these efforts, the Green New Deal and just all of the amazing activism we're seeing around the globe?
Well, I think they're amazing and important because, you know, we can do all the scientific studies in the world that we want, but nothing is going to change unless policymakers make laws and people also are aware of what they can do in their own homes and in cities. And so cities and states and countries really need to change from a policy point of view. And so activists in particular are very good at getting information out and motivating people to make change. So this is really a multi-pronged solution, trying to understand the science of it, trying to get people aware, inform people of the science, and get people motivated to make changes, and then get policymakers to implement policies that will try to hasten the change.
Mark, I listened to a talk you gave in Vancouver in October, and as you said in that talk, there's already so much happening at the state, local, and federal levels. You pointed out that there are a number of bills currently in Congress that embrace 100% renewables. The sad fact is that they've never been voted on, but they are there and they're ready.
Yes, in fact, there are now at least six bills, either resolutions or bills that have been proposed starting back in 2015. There's one House Resolution 540, there's a Senate resolution, and then there are now four bills, I think three in the House and one in the Senate, all calling for 100% clean renewable energy. Most of them are by 2050, and the ones by 2035, two of them are now by 2035 for the electric power sector. A couple of them are for all energy, I believe, and then but many others are for electricity. So there is a lot been proposed, and there are over 100 cities in the United States alone that have committed to 100% renewable energy. There are over 150 international companies that have committed. There are two states that have committed to 100% renewable electric power. Although I should point out, electric power is about only 20% of end-use power demand for all purposes. The other types of energy are from transportation, heating in buildings, heating in industry. And so electric power is really good to solve, because especially if we electrify everything, which we want to do, we want to electrify transportation, we want to electrify heating in buildings and industry. If we do that, then we'll have 100% of our demand will be for electric power, and then converting all the coal-fired power plants and the gas plants to solar and wind and some geothermal will allow us to completely not only decarbonize but eliminate all air pollution, which is a major problem that we're trying to solve too.
You know, Mark, it helped to watch your talk because it was nice to see the graphics. Sometimes when you think about 100% renewable energy, the visuals that come up are wind and solar, because that's the photo that we see almost regularly. But when you think about electrifying everything, and as you say, the main sectors of energy are electricity, transportation, heating, cooling, and industry, that's where it's kind of hard to visualize. So I appreciated seeing all of the, you know, your presentation with all of the photos. So why don't we talk about this? I mean, when you say the idea is to electrify everything, what do you mean exactly?
Well, let's go through each of the sectors. So transportation, we want to transition from gasoline and diesel vehicles to electric vehicles for the most part, and except for some long-distance transportation, like long-distance ships, long-distance planes, some long-distance trains, even some long-distance trucks, we could use hydrogen in a fuel cell where the hydrogen is produced from electricity. So even hydrogen is really electrified energy. And the reason we don't want to, well, we'd want to electrify transportation as much as possible with batteries, but when we get to long-distance transportation, it becomes harder. I mean, short-distance aircraft even, we up to 1,500 kilometers flight, there are planes that are being built to do that, you know, for 50 to 100 passengers, and but beyond that distance, it's, you know, you're basically carrying around more and more batteries, and so more and more of your power is just going to carrying the batteries, and it becomes really inefficient at some point. And so that's where hydrogen steps in for long-distance aircraft. But it turns out that if you electrify, because batteries are so efficient compared to an internal combustion engine and compared to a gasoline vehicle. So, for example, you know, only 17 to 20% of the energy in gasoline goes to move the car, and the rest is just waste heat. So you're wasting about 80 to 83% of all your energy in your gasoline by driving a gasoline car. Whereas an electric car, it's, you know, up to about 90% or more of the electricity that actually gets into the car goes to move the car, and the rest is waste heat. I mean, there's a little bit more loss due to charging the car, but it's, you know, on the order of between 80 and 90% of the electricity from a plug goes to move a car. And so you increase the efficiency by over a factor of 4 by driving an electric car. And averaged worldwide among all energy sectors, if we actually electrified all transportation, including some hydrogen for long distance, we would reduce world power demand 20% just by going to electric cars and hydrogen fuel cell cars going the same distance as we currently are. So that's a big benefit. Then if we look at heating in buildings...
Actually, Mark, can I just stop you? Can we talk for a minute about electric cars? Because, you know, here in the Bay Area, there's just so many people on the streets. And unfortunately, with Uber and Lyft, it just added so many more cars to our highways and our streets. And I just got a release from a group called Veloz, and they follow the electric car market. And they found that Californians are buying electric cars at a sharper rate of increase. Total electric car sales increased 84% from 2017 to 2018. And I've been doing some research on electric cars, and they're still expensive. I mean, the lowest you could probably get is around maybe $25,000 or $30,000. And a lot of people can't afford that. But the technology is changing so fast, and the fees are coming down a bit. But where do you see the electric cars, where do you see it going in the next, say, 5 years?
Well, actually, even though the upfront cost of an electric car is still more than a equivalent gasoline car, it's still cheaper to drive an electric car by far. I mean, much cheaper over the time that you're driving it. Because, for two reasons. I mean, aside from the fact that, first of all, there is still a tax credit in the U.S., but I'll ignore that because we don't want to have to rely on tax credits. But there is a $7,000 tax credit. So even if your car is $5,000 to $10,000 more for the electric car, you can get $7,000 right off from your taxes because it's a credit, not a deduction. But having said that, if you drive your car, like the average person drives 15,000 miles a year, and if you drive it 15 years for 15,000 miles a year, you will save over $20,000 in fuel costs. Because driving a gasoline car, the cost of gasoline is on the order of $4 a gallon, at least where I live. And an electric car is equivalent to driving 80 cents a gallon. If you're plugging into your home and you're plugging in at nighttime electricity rates, it's 80 cents a gallon. And even if you're charging at your work or like one of these charging stations it's maybe $1, $1.50 or something. It's a little bit higher, but it's still, you're saving an enormous amount of money in fuel. So what you're paying up front is way more compensated for by the fuel cost savings over 15 years of driving that car. But the other thing is, it's just the health benefit alone is just so enormous compared to your gasoline car. And that affects not only you and your, because you're breathing your own exhaust and you're breathing other people's exhaust on their roads. You know, so in California alone, there are about 13,000 people die every year from air pollution still. Mm. And a lot of this is from, a good portion of it, I'd say on the order of 40%, is from vehicle exhaust. So that costs, by the way, it costs on the order of 3% of the GDP of the state due to the health costs from this air pollution. So there's a significant social cost that everybody benefits from lower insurance rates, lower hospitalization rates, lower workman's compensation rates, lower taxes, and fewer lost work days, lost school days, you know, higher productivity. So there is this benefit that most people, you know, that maybe you can't see it directly because it's like hidden in your taxes and hidden in your insurance rates, but it's there. So there's right. this multiple benefits of transitioning to electricity.
And also, since I've been doing so much research on this, I mean, you can lease an electric car, which is what a lot of people do because the technology is getting better so quickly, for like maybe $2,500, $3,000 down, and then the car is about $300 a month. And as you said, Mark, I mean, a lot of people spend between $200, $300 a month just in gas. Do you think that, or will there be technology coming out that would allow people to transition their conventional car or retrofit their car to an electric engine? I'm just thinking of all the cars that are out there. What do we do with all of those?
Right. Well, I think it's much, ultimately, yeah, trying to transition a car to an electric, it's probably better to have a new car and recycle mm-hmm. the old car. Just because I think it's, you know, even every car is different, and so I think it's less efficient to actually try to retrofit cars, and you probably get errors in the retrofit. Trying to really, because we don't want, you know, just to buy a new electric car and then your old car gets recycled and is still used. We really need to retire those from the road. So really have a big recycling program for cars. I got my first electric car in 2009 and it worked right away. So it's not much of a transition. You know, I think the hardest thing is you're adjusting from going to a gas station to either charging in your own home or charging, you know, sometimes people get range anxiety because they're worried about not having enough electricity in the car to go certain distances. But, you know, electric cars now, they go 300 miles and on a charge. And it used to be, you know, a few years ago, most of them were like 50 miles. But now, you know, the Chevy Bolt, for example, it's 293 miles. And there are other ones that are small cars that go, you know, similar distances. The Tesla Model 3 is another example of that. So there's technology is changing a lot and really rapidly, and I think the biggest limitation is putting a charging infrastructure, because we don't want people to have range anxiety, and we want people to be able to charge. I know, like in Paris, you have chargers right on the street. You know, like they're not necessarily in shopping centers or what you can see now, but just on this, just like a parking meter, there are charging stations where you can just, you know, you're parking, even if it's temporarily, and you can charge. So this is really the thing we need, is just a huge growth of charging stations, because even though there are now a lot of charging stations, it's still you want to make this as simple as possible for people.
Right. And Mark, we have a few callers specifically on this issue. Judy couldn't stay on, but says a friend just bought a used electric Chevy for $4,000. And we have another related question from Bill in Mountain View. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks a lot for having Professor Jacobson on. I'm a fan. I do have a question, though, about the, if you look at the overall population of vehicles on the roads in California, I sense it as being really resistant to change, flipping the population over from legacy cars to greener cars, mainly because all those Toyotas from the, you know, the awesome Toyota production system and all those Hondas and stuff, those are 25 or 30 year vehicles. And even if you have a pretty good program of funding to get older cars off the road, if I was part of the working poor, which I'm a retiree and I'm not, but I would buy, or I would take the $3,000 for the car, trade it into the state, you know, turn around, buy another $1,200 car. Mm-hmm. So it's not clear that that giant population is necessarily open to subsidies and whatnot, because practicality of getting to work is a bigger issue. You still got to have a car, and it's going to be a $1,200 car, and those darn things go on forever.
Yeah. Well, that does call for, I mean, certainly when the current population of new electric cars gets older, there will be a market for used electric cars, a larger market. There's some right now, but you're right. There are a lot of issues that need to be resolved, and they're not exactly clear what's the easiest pathway forward. But from a societal point of view, so I can see it from an individual's point of view. There are all these decisions that are hard. But from the policymaker's point of view, it's really a job of the policymakers to make the best decisions for society, and that will benefit everybody the most, including the poor people who don't have the funds to, you know, purchase new cars. And so part of this is also public transportation, which we haven't mentioned, and trying to reduce car use, which was alluded to earlier. Certainly, ride sharing is another way to get around. I mean, I think a lot of people, especially younger people now, you know, they don't even want to have a car because of the ride sharing. Now, if we can make all Ubers and Lyfts and, you know, electric, that will also go a long way towards making things more efficient. You know, a lot of people won't have to own a car, and it's, you know, it's a lot easier to ride share, and especially if you don't have to own a car. And, you know, in public transportation is another thing, and that can be improved and can be electrified along the way. So there are a lot of things that can be done in cities, and cities are doing things. I know one city that just made all public transportation free, and it was going to be electric with electric trains.
And, wow. What city is that?
Yeah, I should know. It was just last week this happened. So, but I forget which city it was, but it was a city that made all their, that decided to make electric trains and make the public transportation free. So that was really cool.
Well, that is a fantastic idea, to make public transportation free. Well, thank you so much for the call. We have one more question on cars. Let's go to Gail in San Francisco. Hi, Gail.
Hi. Thank you for the program. My concern is the unintended consequences. You have, you know, the great idea of all electric, but getting rid of batteries is a problem. And what are we going to do when it's not just AA batteries, but great big car batteries piling up in the future? And then, two, the concept of going to all renewable has some concerns with the environmental impact of large solar energy and wind energy farms. And also, it's my understanding that the manufacturer of the photovoltaic cells in the solar panels still uses a lot of toxic chemicals, so we a lot of toxic waste. So I'd just like to hear your comments on that.
Yeah, sure. Well, first of all, the batteries are recycled, and most of them are intended to be recycled. I know Tesla has a big recycling program for the batteries, so they take all the components out. And they do, well, first of all, they do last a long time. I mean, the electric car I have from 2009 has the same batteries, and it's only lost about 20% of the range, which was pretty long in the first place. And so they, you know, these are batteries that, so they're 10-year-old batteries, and they're still going strong. And, you know, they, at first, a few years ago, they didn't know how long the batteries would last. Might say maybe 7 years, but I think they're, you know, 10 to 12 years is more likely, or even up to 15 years. But, so they will be recycled, and they're also one time in materials that you're using for them. Now, compare that with fossil fuels, where you're continuously mining, transporting, refining fossil fuels forever to run your car. So, you know, like if your battery is stored in your car for at least, you know, let's say 10 years before it comes out and it's recycled, and so it's not doing any damage to the environment. Meanwhile, in the United States alone, there are 50,000 oil and gas wells drilled every year, that, and the entire fossil fuel industry takes up 1.3% of the United States land area due to the whole infrastructure. And it's increasing, you know, 50,000 wells a year just to satisfy our energy demand. So it's really, it's such an incredibly small footprint from, let's say, batteries compared to the drilling for oil and gas for driving cars. When I say gas, like liquefied natural gas is used for cars as well. And then in terms of the wind farms and the solar farms, there are impacts, but again, even, let's say, birds, people are concerned with birds for wind farms. And birds in the United States, about 600,000, I'd say, birds are killed today from wind farms each year. It sounds like a lot, but in comparison, well, first of all, fossil fuels kill 10 times the birds per unit energy as a wind farm. And so when you replace a coal plant or a gas plant with a wind farm, you're reducing your bird kills by a factor of 10. That's because not only air pollution from the fossil fuel plants, but the mining and drilling that destroys their habitat and the buildings themselves. But let's even put it in a different perspective. Communication towers in the United States kill about 10 to 50 million birds a year, and electric and transmission towers are about similar. Buildings are about 1 billion birds per year, that's windows and buildings. And then cats are about 3 billion birds a year in the United States alone. So we're talking a few hundred thousand, up to maybe up to a million, and if you grow it, wind to power, you know, let's say 25 to 30% of the United States electric power for all purposes, might have up to 1 million to 2 million birds deaths per year, and we're trying to avoid those by lots of measures, but it still pales in comparison to 3 billion birds per year killed by cats. So it's really a red herring. In terms of the solar, yeah, it takes up land area, but the total land area to power the entire world for all purposes with solar and wind primarily, and that includes all the onshore wind and all the solar photovoltaics and concentrated solar plants in deserts, is about 0.6 to 0.7%, so less than 1% of the world land area. As I mentioned, the fossil fuel industry already takes 1.3% of the world's land area. Well, sorry, it's the U.S. land area, and it's similar worldwide. And so you'd actually reduce your land requirements. Where there are over 500,000 gas stations worldwide and over 100,000 in the United States. We'd eliminate those, all the pipelines, all the oil refineries, all the gas storage stations, all the oil and gas wells, and... Yeah, there are a couple million of them, active and inactive oil and gas wells in the United States. So there's this huge infrastructure that we'd eliminate, and we replace it with a smaller infrastructure with wind and solar primarily.
Well, thank you for the call, Gail. Today it is our One Planet series, and we're speaking with Mark Jacobson, Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Stanford and Director of its Atmosphere and Energy Program. Mark led a study that identifies how 139 countries could obtain 100% of their energy from renewable sources by 2050. It's a very in-depth study, as you can hear from how Mark is answering everyone's questions. And so we're talking about what that would actually look like. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. We are continuing our month-long series on solutions this week. Tomorrow, we will talk about what is being done to support caregivers. The number of caregivers in the country is just drastically increasing because people are living longer, but they're living with chronic conditions. So we'll talk about that tomorrow. Wednesday, we'll talk with mothers whose kids were shot by police. They are organizing around transparency and accountability. And then Thursday, what would a just and healthy economy actually look like to truly tackle inequality and poverty? Today, we're talking about what it will take to get to 100% renewable energy. We're talking about it with Mark Jacobson, Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Stanford. He's director of their Atmosphere and Energy Program. Mark Jacobson is co-founder of the Solutions Project. He led a study that identifies how 139 countries around the world could obtain 100% of their energy from renewable sources by 2050. They've got a clear plan that lays it all out. The idea is to electrify everything. And we've been talking about transportation. And Mark, we clearly have to do an entire show about cars because we're getting so many phone calls about cars. And we're going to move on, but I just want to take Edie in Belmont, who has been waiting patiently. Hi, Edie.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'm really excited about the work you're doing. I'm concerned about an electric car getting somewhere and being stuck. So I'm wondering about not just cars, but why can't we put solar on the items that use the electricity, like cars, buildings, that kind of thing?
You can put a solar panel on a car, and in fact, people have done that, but it's only going to help a little bit. Because you do need a much larger area to power the car. But you can put it on the roof of a building, and so the solar is going up on buildings. In fact, all buildings in California, all new buildings, will have to have solar on them as of 2020 by law to power the house. In fact, in my own home, I built a home that has no gas, and it has solar and has batteries, and there are heat pumps to provide heating for air and water, and there are electric cars, including with all my family, the three electric cars that are being charged with the solar on the roof. And so you can actually charge it. In fact, having done that, so I have no gas, and I paid no gas bill, and I also paid no electric bill last year, and I paid no gasoline bill, and I produced 20% more electricity than I consumed from the solar on the roof, and so I sent that back to the grid, and there are these community choice aggregation utilities now, and mine was Silicon Valley Clean Energy, that take over the generation portion of your bill, and they paid up to the rate that I would have been charged for using energy at that same time, and so they gave me a check at the end of the year for $530. So no gas bill, no gasoline bill, no electric bill, and got paid for the electricity. And even though there was an upfront cost of doing this, it'll pay itself off after about 5 to 6 years. And that's with the fact that there are tax credits for these things. But if there are no tax credits, it would take about 10 years. So it's something that's worthwhile for new homes to actually be able to put in enough solar to charge their own cars. But in terms of the range anxiety that you referred to, most new electric cars, at least the ones you want to buy, are the ones with long-distance range that go, 200 at the minimum, but, ideally 250 to 350 or 400 miles would be a car you would drive. And so it's something, if you haven't driven an electric car before and you first start, you do have this range anxiety, but then you kind of figure it out. And Now there's so many options for charging, at least in a lot of places, not everywhere, but a lot of places there are many charging stations that are public, at workplaces and in shopping centers, and then you can also just find, there are apps that online that you can just find where a charging station is, your nearest charging station. There are lots of phone apps that you can locate charging stations. And so that really ameliorates some of the range anxiety, especially, you know, if you're going to work and you have a regular commute, you'll kind of know what your range is and you'll know when you have to charge. So so that problem goes away. I mean, I have zero range anxiety now, but when I first got my first electric car, I did. And at that time, they had hardly any charging stations externally, so I was relying mostly on my own charging station. But I would actually take trips to Sacramento and Fresno, and I would find, even then they had apps that you could find places to charge cars. And I once charged my car in the in a mobile home park near Fresno, outside of it, in the middle of the night. So it was a pretty... my heart was a little throbbing because I thought I was going to run out of electricity and be stranded. But I actually never ended up getting stranded, even though I did have this fear of it at the time.
Well, Edie, thank you for the call, and we will definitely do another show specifically on electric cars, and we'll talk about the subsidies, what we can do to ensure that people who are on a low income or struggle to make ends meet, you know, they can't afford electric cars. So we're going to talk about what it would take to ensure that they're available for people. We will also do a show about public transportation, because that's so, so important. We need to get more cars off the road. Mark, let's talk about another sector here. Again, the idea is to electrify everything. We talked about transportation. Let's talk about electricity. In your talk, this was fascinating. For heating and cooling, you're talking about using heat pumps for low temperature building heat. So heat pumps use a quarter of the energy of gas heaters or electric heaters. Tell us more about these heat pumps.
Right. So, yeah, heat pumps have been around for a while, but they're different from your gas heater or even electric resistance heater because they don't actually produce heat. They just move it around, whereas a gas heater will, you'll burn gas and produce heat directly, or an electric resistance heater will basically produce electricity just from running electricity, sorry, produce heat from running electricity through resistance, and that resistance will create heat. So, you know, one unit of electricity in an electric resistance heater produces about one unit of heat. Now, in a gas heater, about one unit of electricity, sorry, one unit of gas energy produces about 0.8 units of heat. So it's a little less efficient than a resistance heater. However, with a heat pump, one unit of electricity produces 4 units of heat. Or if it's a ground source heat pump, it's like 5 units, and if it's an air source, it's closer to 3 units. But it's not actually creating heat in the case of the heat pump; it's just moving it. So, for example, with a heat pump in your home, you'd have an indoor unit and an outdoor unit, and let's say it's really cold in your house and you want heat, then you basically run the cold air over these coils in your indoor unit of your heat pump, and those heat from there's a coolant. Instead of having ducts, what you have is a coolant that actually extracts heat from the outside air and brings it inside, and so the coolant then exchanges heat with the air, the cold air inside, and makes your air inside warm, and it also runs in reverse and provides air conditioning. So the nice thing about heat pumps is they run in one direction to producing heat, in another direction they produce cold, so they function, do both functions. They are basically like when they are air conditioners, they function just like an air conditioner when you're doing cooling. I mean, air conditioners actually work exactly like a heat pump, except air conditioners don't run in reverse to produce heat. And same thing with refrigerators. I mean, refrigerators are like heat pumps that produce cooling, but refrigerators don't run in reverse to produce heat. So anyway, the point is that you're using, on average, 1/4 the energy to produce heat or to move heat with a heat pump than you do with an electric resistance heater or a gas heater. So heating is one of the biggest demands for energy in the world. In fact, there's four times more in the United States, there's four times more heating demand than there is for cooling demand. And especially in winter, heating demand goes up, and so gas use goes up because most people's heating is with natural gas. And so if you can actually electrify all building heat for not only residences but commercial buildings, and then use heat pumps to provide that heat, you know, your energy demand for heating will go down 75%. Averaged over the entire world in all energy sectors, if we converted all building heating and also water heating as well, because you can use heat pumps for a water heater as well. I have one in my home. It's a heat pump water heater. Averaged over all energy sectors, you'll reduce world power demand about 15% by moving everything to heat pumps. So I mentioned before, you can reduce power demand 20% by going to electric vehicles. You can reduce it another 15% by going to heat pumps. So that's 35% right there. You can reduce power demand worldwide another 4% by electrifying industry. So that's 39%. You can reduce it another 12.5% by just electrifying all energy, because you eliminate the energy in mining, transporting, and refining fossil fuels. 12.5% of all energy worldwide is just used to dig up coal, oil, and gas and transport it to where it's needed and then process it. And so we don't need that because we have wind turbines. The wind comes right to the turbine, the solar comes right to the panel, so you can save 12.5% of all energy worldwide right there. We can get another 7% reduction of total world power demand just by end-use energy efficiency improvements. And so therefore, we have 59% of our current energy demand, and also in the future energy demand, we can eliminate by electrifying everything without people changing their habits. And so then we want to provide the rest of that energy, which is all electricity in our world, future world, with wind and water and solar power.
In your talk, Mark, you pointed out that we're talking about floating offshore wind. There's one offshore in Scotland, and the capacity is 67%, which is pretty incredible. You also pointed out that California is looking at permitting floating offshore wind. You can power two-thirds of California with floating offshore wind. I mean, that's a massive breakthrough.
Yeah, I mean, because the ocean has so much wind energy, and the problem to date has been that there haven't been floating turbines. So there have been offshore wind turbines that you have to drill into the ocean floor. But that works when you have shallow ocean water. But off California's coast, the water gets pretty deep pretty fast. Off the east coast of the U.S., it stays shallow for 200 miles out. So you can have a lot of offshore wind with kind of the non-floating technologies. But for California to take advantage of resources, you know, this floating offshore wind will really open up the potential to power a huge portion of California with offshore wind, and people won't even have to complain about the turbines because they don't never see them, because you can put them far enough offshore that they're out of your sight.
And what about ocean life? How will that affect underwater life?
Well, the studies that have been performed so far, I mean, they've had offshore wind in Europe for over 20, 25 years, and what they find is that coral reefs build up around the bases of the turbines. These are the ones that are stuck into the ocean floor. There haven't been other negative impacts. I mean, there are probably some bird kills as I mentioned before, those are in comparison to other sources of bird deaths, and in comparison to even fossil fuel bird deaths, it's small. So I haven't heard any negative impacts. You don't have oil spills associated with like wind turbines, offshore wind turbines. You can't have a wind spill. So it's not the same as offshore oil. I think the biggest thing people complain about is the site. Some people do like that site, but again, these will be located far enough offshore, the floating ones will be, that you won't ever see them. And even if the ones that are existing, the existing offshore wind farms, generally, you know, you can stick your hand out, your arm out as far as you can, and the size of the turbine is about the size of your thumb. And you know, in half the days you would never see them because there's enough sea spray to block your view, or clouds or fog. So it's not. I think there's relatively minor impact compared to the benefit, the huge benefit of offshore wind.
Today we're speaking about 100% renewable energy and how we can get there with Mark Jacobson, professor of civil and environmental engineering at Stanford. He's co-founder of the Solutions Project, which aims to make renewable energy a reality in 139 countries around the world by the year 2050. And we have a number of calls, so let's go back to our listeners. Let's hear from Max in Berkeley. Hi, Max.
Thank you for taking my call. A very interesting program as usual. I have a quick question for you. I have read about an interesting bit of research that's going on. It has to do with the way we use our roads, okay? It has to do with the idea of replacing asphalt, okay, to surface the roads by something that would incorporate photovoltaic cells and that would produce electricity whenever there is sunshine. That the work, the research application is being done in China and in France also, I believe. But the thing is that we have roads everywhere in the world. And, of course, the roads are in proximity with the places where the energy, the electricity is consumed. I wonder if there is any value to this. Have you heard about that at all?
Yes, I'm very familiar with it. Well, technically, in theory, it's a nice idea to make roads of solar panels. The practical problems are it's not an efficient use of solar panels. I mean, because not only do you have to have tougher panels so they're more expensive so they don't break, but they get road dust on them, and there's a lot of road dust that covers them, so that reduces their efficiency. It's harder to repair, it's a lot more efficient if you can build a canopy over a road and put the solar panels on that. Like you've seen probably canopies over parking structures and even over fields and parking lots. I think it's a lot more efficient to put a solar panel above a parking lot or even over a road or a train track high above it where you have a canopy above it so that you're not continuously beating down on the panel and you get less dust on the panel. So it's a lot easier to repair, it doesn't break as much, and it doesn't get as dirty. And so the cost, I've seen some numbers there, had some test road panels put up, and the costs were like enormous compared to normal solar panels. I mean, utility scale solar photovoltaics are really cheap today, because you can do them en masse in sunny places, and they're kept in a good, a relatively clean environment. And so, utility scale solar and utility scale wind are the cheapest forms of electric power in the world right now. But, the solar roads are probably on the order of like 5 to 10 times more expensive per unit energy generated because they're just not so efficient for the reasons I've described. And they just cost a lot to install. I don't think that's the best use of solar.
All right. Thank you for that, Max. Let's hear from Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg.
Hello. Before I forget, you just brought something up that I think is very interesting, and that is that California has miles and miles of canals that are built to transport water. You could easily, I think, cover those canals with solar panels. That's my guess. You accomplish two things. One, you get electricity, and two, you might cut down on evaporation because that's just they're running through the valley where it's really hot, and so that's one thing. I wanted to ask you about Stanford, though. What's Stanford doing to solarize their campus? And then secondly, what about the relationship between your hope that you could solarize everything and growth? The economy, the world economy is based on growth. How do those two factors work together? Because you could solarize everything, but if you keep on growing and keep on building and developing, we're going to have continued problems. So I would just be curious to hear what you have to say about that.
Yeah. Well, first, I do agree about the canals. There is floating solar now, and it's being put up in a lot of places. You can put it over lakes and reservoirs and canals, and that, would reduce evaporation as well as provide you have... You don't really need to take up new land because that's already existing infrastructure. You can also put solar panels between wind turbines. That's a dual use of the land. With regard to Stanford, actually, Stanford has a commitment to be 100% renewable electricity and heat by 2020, and it's about 70% there. It's actually, so what it did was it used to have a natural gas cogeneration plant, which is actually right outside my office until a few years ago, and they bulldozed it, and that provided 80% of the campus electricity and heat, and it was removed and replaced with an elaborate heating and cooling system. So there are two chillers and a boiler and an elaborate piping system that would basically take waste heat and waste cold from around the university and ship it to the chillers and heaters for storage, and then ship it around again to different places in the university which needed the heat and cold. And then they combined that by buying 60 megawatts of solar, a solar plant in a desert down south. And then just recently, in the last couple months, it actually then purchased additional solar, another 70 megawatts of solar, and that combined with the 60 megawatts and another 5 to 10 megawatts that are on campus, it'll actually, and there's that, by the way, the new farm that they just purchased will be up in 2020, and so once that's up, the campus will be 100% clean renewable electricity and almost 100% clean renewable heat, and it has a goal to go renewable transportation by 2025. So I think it's doing a lot. In terms of growth, our roadmaps that we've developed for countries and cities and states and towns, they're all based on 2050 data, so accounting for the growth of not only population but energy use. In fact, you know, we projected that energy use would double worldwide by 2050. And that's where these energy efficiency improvements that I mentioned, that if we actually transition, if we electrify everything and provide that electricity with clean renewable energy, that reduces power demand around 59% across all energy sectors. And then we'd provide the remainder with wind and water and solar. So we've calculated out for each country, you know, how much exactly we would need of each of these technologies. And there is plenty, there's so much solar in the world. There's literally like 500 times more solar in over land in practical locations than we need to power the entire world for all purposes. So there's 500 times more. So we do have room for growth. I'm not advocating growth, but I'm saying we're not, like, there's plenty of energy if we actually do this right, if we do the system right and actually electrify everything, provide that electricity with clean renewable energy, and storage costs are coming down too, because the wind doesn't always blow, the sun doesn't always shine, and battery costs have just dropped dramatically. And we now have these huge battery storage systems going in, and cheaper solar plus storage now is cheaper than natural gas for providing peaking power. And so this is enabling this transition. So the costs are favorable now, and the technology's got to a point where it's pretty straightforward, and we just need to motivate people to make the change.
Mark, how do you see this playing out at the federal level over the next couple of years? The New York Times had an incredible piece, but also pretty depressing, called 78 Environmental Rules on the Way Out Under Trump. And so with the Republican Party, for the majority of the party, you've got climate deniers, oil and gas, really making the decisions, really running the show. On the Democratic side, there's a lot of different levels of what a Green New Deal would look like. But how do you see this playing out in the next couple of years? Because, you know, according to this UN report, we just don't have much time. We need to make major changes today.
Right. Yeah, at the federal level, they're not helping. And so that's why at the state level and at the local level, a lot bit more is going on. I mean, it turns out in the United States, nine out of ten states with the most wind power installed are all Republican states. And that's just because there's a lot of wind there, but it's also because it's so cheap. I mean, wind is the cheapest form of electric power in the United States today, followed closely by utility scale solar. And, you know, so, you know, basically people want low cost electricity. So it's most Democrats or Republicans don't really care about politics when it comes to what energy they want to purchase, as long as it's cheap. But that doesn't mean that the leadership, though, is really trying to, you know, keep coal alive. They're trying to give favors to gas and to oil. And so they're not helping. But there is still a federal tax credit for wind and solar, and there's still electric vehicle tax credits. So they haven't, like, killed everything, but they haven't done anything, you know, positive since the last administration. So it's kind of been a status quo, which is as good as we can expect. But I think you know, so much is going on at the state and local level that it might not matter, you know, in the long run. It might not matter. And also companies are changing too. So the federal government may be less relevant than we're worried about in the long run. But they certainly could do more to help.
Because you point out in your talk that 42% of Iowa's electricity comes from wind.
Yeah, that's right. And it used to, you know, in the year 2000, it was like 2 or 3%. Now it's up to 42, wow, or even might even be more this year. And they're growing. They actually, the utilities in Iowa, they plan to go to up to like 65-70% wind within the next year or two. So it has nothing to do with the politics in Washington, what people in the individual states are actually doing. And Florida is now growing their solar, and Texas has a huge amount of solar and wind going up still. And in the South, North Carolina, there are at least 14 towns and cities alone in North Carolina that have committed to 100% renewable energy,
wow,
including some places you'd never expect, small towns and counties.
Well, so there's so much change really happening, and I'll put a link to your talk at yourcallradio.org. For those of you who would like more detailed information about how to really electrify everything, electricity, transportation, heating, cooling, and industry, Mark Jacobson is professor of civil and environmental engineering at Stanford, and he led a study that identifies how 139 countries around the globe could obtain 100% of their energy from renewable sources by 2050. Mark, thank you so much for your work, and thanks for joining us.
No, thanks so much for having me on the show.
Thank you. Coming up tomorrow, we'll continue our month-long series on solutions by talking about what we can do to support caregivers. I hope you can join us for that. Thanks to Laura Wenis for producing today's show, and Kevin Vance, our studio engineer, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.